Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Hi, everybody. I'm Stesha Brandon. I'm the Literature and Humanities Program Manager here at the library. Welcome to the library and to today's event with Elan Mastai. And I wanted to thank Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to co-present this event. I also wanted to thank our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, the Seattle Times, and the Seattle Public Library Foundation for their generous support of library programs. Now let me turn the podium over to Karen Maeda-Ullman from Elliott Bay Book Company because she gets the fun part and she's going to introduce the rest of the program.
Good afternoon. It's wonderful to see so many of you out here on this beautiful day to see Elan Mastai. I'd like to point out that he's an international writer, even though he's originally from Vancouver and now lives in Toronto. We actually host many authors from Canada, and I always like to kind of point that out because there's always Canadians in the audience and hopefully fans of Canadian literature. So we'll call him both Canadian and international. He has a background in screenwriting, probably best known for his film What Is. It's also known as the F Word, and for this he won the Canadian Screen Award for Best Adapted Screenplay and also a Writers Guild of Canada Award for Best Screenplay. And All Are Wrong Today's is his debut novel. And yes, it's a novel about time travel, and that's something that's been a bit of a preoccupation for me lately. Maybe I'm not alone here in that. And it's a novel about love and loss of a mother. And I think that has special resonance for those of us who have lost ours. And that, for me, really infused the book with a lot of melancholy and longing. And so also is pretty funny as well. Independent Booksellers Nationwide nominated All Are Wrong Today's for the Indies Next List, and it's number one this month. And it's the love of books and the experience of reading real books on the page and of a certain bookstore in the book. And that's very much linked here to the sense of being transported, of layers of knowledge, and about the memory of seeing your loved one's connection to books influencing your own capacity and love for reading. Today, I think many of us may have seen a lovely interview that Nicole Broder conducted in the Seattle Times. If not, I invite you to go back and take a look at that. And then he shared in that interview that the novel has been optioned for a screenplay, which he's currently writing. So look forward to that as well. So our author will speak today. He'll do a little reading and take some questions in the audience about his work. And then afterwards, he'll be signing books at the front table. And I have copies for sale at the back table. So thank you for joining us. And please join me in welcoming Elan Mastai to the Seattle Public Library.
Thank you very much. I just want to say in advance that I flew in from San Francisco and my ears have not popped. So I feel like I'm screaming at you right now. I don't want you to feel that you're in trouble, because you're not in trouble. I asked a number of author friends, you know, it's my very first book tour. The book only came out on Tuesday. You know, what to expect, you know, any advice they have. And they just said, just know that nobody will come to any of your events because your book just came out. You don't have a readership. And so I just want to say thank you so much for coming, for proving them wrong. It's a terrific crowd, and I just want to say thank you to the Seattle Public Library and to Elliott Bay Books and to the Seattle Times for the piece they did today and to you for coming. You're reminded by just looking behind me at how beautiful it is out there, and you're here inside in this gorgeous temple to literature. And so I just want to say thank you. I love this particular branch of the library. I was here just a few years after the library opened, and I remember that first breathtaking view, just kind of turning the corner and seeing this incredible building. And actually, there's a piece of the book, and I don't think I've ever mentioned this before, that it was inspired by that moment when I first saw this building, which I'll talk about in a second. And so it sort of feels a little bit full circle to be here. So thank you very much. I want to talk about the book, and I want to tell you a little bit about myself. And I'm also happy to answer any questions anybody has. I think it's sort of helpful sometimes to kind of talk about a little bit of my family history, just to sort of position where I come from. I was born in Vancouver, but my grandfather was born in New York City. He grew up in the Depression. He became a chemist. He'd wanted to be a writer, but it was the Great Depression, and you know, I mean, a chemist seemed like a more kind of, you know, something that was a little more sustainable. His work ended up bringing him to Chicago, and he pioneered a way of synthesizing vitamins, which proved important for the war effort. So he didn't go off to war because it was very difficult, of course, to get healthy, nutritious meals to the soldiers on the front. So his work was considered essential. My grandmother grew up in Vienna in Austria, and when she was a teenager, her family had to escape, from the war, from the Nazis. She was on one of the Kinder transports to England. And she became like a teenage au pair in London before she was able to rejoin her family in Chicago and become an American citizen. And that's where my grandparents met. It's where my mother was born. Later in life, the family moved to Vancouver, and she ended up in England, in London, in the late 60s, doing street theater and working for working at the Institute for Contemporary Art Gallery. She ended up running out of money and took a job teaching in Israel. And one day she was walking down the street and was feeling a little peckish, and so she walked into a coffee shop, and that's where she met my father. My father had been born in Marrakesh. His family had to escape as well during the Second World War and ended up on the French-Swiss border hiding out until after the war. And then they immigrated to Israel. And so by the time my dad was 10, he'd lived in three different continents. He became a lawyer, and there was a coffee shop underneath his office that he'd eat at sometimes. And just that day, my parents met by coincidence. You know, if she had chosen a different coffee shop, if he had left a few minutes earlier, they ran into each other in the doorway and struck up a conversation. He ended up moving with her to Vancouver because her experiences in London, although she went there to act, she got very into the art world, and she came back to Canada to do her PhD, and that's where I was born. That's where my sisters were born, and I've lived most of my life there. But growing up, I was very aware of the fact that every single person around the dinner table was there because of these grand sweeps of history that seemed like they had nothing to do with me, but also had everything to do with the fact that I even existed. You know, my mom and my grandparents on her side were American. As I said, my father was from a number of different continents in his young age, and so I always felt kind of poised between those two, between the sort of North American perspective and the world perspective, but also that sense that something as sort of essential and natural as your family could just be the result of all these sort of historical circumstances. Growing up in Vancouver in the 80s, you know, my grandfather, as I said, he was a chemist, and he had this big collection of old 40s and 50s and 60s science fiction. You know, those old pulp anthologies that you know, they weren't even made to be kept. They were made to be read and thrown out, but he kept them all. And as a kid, I loved them. I loved peeling the magazines off the shelf and staring at these kind of garishly painted covers of futuristic cityscapes and flying cars and robots and, you know, bases on the moon. But as a kid in the 80s, you know, I was aware that it wasn't turning out. The future wasn't turning out the way they thought it would. You know, I did not get a jetpack for my 10th birthday, and that seemed like a terrible crime. So I was fascinated by that. And then the other big thing that happened, for those of you who are firm or grew up in Seattle, you might remember Expo 86. That happened when I was a kid in Vancouver, and I loved it, and it just blew my mind. They built a monorail. There was like robots zooming around. McDonald's built a restaurant on a barge. I don't know why that was part of the future, but it was for Expo 86. And of course, it was part of this continuity of these World's Fairs, like the New York World's Fair of 64, Expo 67 in Montreal, this kind of optimistic kind of techno-utopian vision of the future that mirrored the vision of the future from my grandfather's kind of science fiction. It's only recently that I discovered, when I went back to look at it, that Expo 86 was actually the last World's Fair ever hosted in North America. We kind of stopped doing them here. We sort of stopped dreaming of the future in the same way. And that's something else that I was very interested in, you know, that idea that our visions of the future have evolved from the utopian ideals of the post-war generation to a much more dystopian outlook. Sometimes you can feel dystopian just by looking at Twitter these days. But the book became, the initial genesis of the book was, I was interested in both of those things. What happened to the future we were supposed to have? And also, what would somebody from my grandfather's generation think landing suddenly in our present if they looked around. And so All Our Wrong Today is my novel. It's about a character who comes from, it's set in the present, but it's this alternate version of the present, this techno-utopian future that we were promised by the post-war generation that they were sure was going to happen. And through a series of circumstances, he finds himself stranded in our 2016, what we think of as the real world, but which to him seems like this dystopia where everything's gone wrong. Of course, he wants to get back to the version of the world that he comes from, but along the way, he discovers these very unexpected versions of the people in his life, his family, this woman he has this romantic connection with, and himself. He's a very different person. And that sort of makes it a much more complicated decision. I divided the book into two parts. There's three parts to the book, and the first part is set in that alternate version of the world. I'm fascinated by technology, but not on its own, not just on its own. I'm fascinated by the implications of technology. And a concept that I explore in the book is what I call the accident. It's that idea that every time you introduce a new kind of technology, you also introduce the accident of that technology. There's no such thing as a car crash until you invent the car. There's no such thing as a plane crash until you invent the plane. There's no such thing as a nuclear meltdown until you invent the nuclear power plant. I've been thinking about that a lot in terms of the internet lately. I think a lot of us are probably meditating on what the internet means to us. You know, it's this incredible resource, this network where all of human knowledge is available to us at the click of a button. But at the same time, it has this effect of making all information equal, fact, fiction, become a matter of choice. You know, people can choose the subjective reality they want to live in instead of this objective reality of facts that we all, used to live in. And so that idea of the unintended consequence of the internet is something I'm thinking a lot about. And so this book explores not just all this dazzling technology, but also the implications of it, how it affects people. Because fundamentally, you know, all these ideas and theories that are in the book about technology, it's great. I could write a blog post about it, but you read a book because of the characters and how it affects the people. And I think of that idea of the accident also applying to the people in our life. Anytime you meet somebody new, you introduce both the positive possibilities, but also the unintended consequences, the accident of that person. I talk about that in the book, that there's no intimacy without consequence. And so the book explores both the consequences of technology, both intended and unintended, but also the consequences of the people in our lives. And that was important to me. And as my protagonist comes from his version of the world and is stranded in our version of the world through a series of circumstances which involve the unintended consequences of a prototype time machine, I wanted to bring him into our version of the world and start stripping away all the things that he thinks are essential to himself. In his version of the world, it's not just that technology seems to have solved all of humanity's problems. War, crime, illness, disease, these things aren't problems for humanity anymore. But that doesn't mean that all of human problems are solved. Doesn't mean that you're not going to still have conflicts with your parents, challenges romantically, difficulty finding your place in the world. In fact, sometimes it's harder to find your place in a world where nothing is asked of you, where there's no sense of responsibility. You know, you don't have to clean up your messes because a robot will do it for you. In our version of the world, I mean, sometimes that would be very nice, don't get me wrong. In our version of the world, which is incredibly disconcerting for the character at first, his actions have consequences. Nobody will clean up his mess for him. He has to start learning to take responsibility. And although my protagonist is, 32 years old when we meet him, it's like he hasn't really been required to come of age. And that's sort of one of the subtle things that I try to explore as the book progresses, how, yes, there's all this sort of the dazzling effects of technology. It seems like this better world, but as the layers of what becomes important to him are peeled away, he starts to really interrogate what does give his life meaning, what gives his life purpose, and has he really been living the kind of life that he can be proud of, and sometimes taking responsibility for the consequences of your actions, even though you know no one's going to rescue, you're the only one who's going to save yourself, actually give your life meaning, and particularly as that pertains to the people in your life. As a writer, I've been a screenwriter for a number of years, as was mentioned. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book is because I love books, and I wanted to write a book that was very much in love with the experience of reading a book. As a screenwriter, I've worked in a bunch of different genres, but the thing about a screenplay is the writing style is always the same. A screenplay is always written in the third person. It's always written in the present tense. It's a very visually dynamic way of writing, but it's also a very lean and laconic kind of writing style. And it's also a transitionary document. When you go to see a movie, you fortunately do not see, the screenplay pages projected onto the wall of the movie theater. I've tried to get them to do that, but they insist on putting actors in it. And so I like the collaborative aspect of movie making. It's one of the things I enjoy about it as a screenwriter. If you don't like to find out, if you don't like to see what your work evokes in others, it's the wrong job for you. And so having spent a number of years collaborating with directors and producers and actors and crew on the movies, I found myself feeling like I wanted to stretch different muscles. And I had a story to tell, and I felt like a book was the way to tell it. At the same time, and so, I felt very free using all these literary tools and tricks and techniques that I never had access to. It was invigorating for me as a writer. At the same time, you do have to still show the same kind of discipline. In fact, it's more so because I don't have some pretty actors who will make my dialogue sound wonderful and a director who will have a swooping camera. It's about the words, even more so than it normally is, and that sense of responsibility to the reader to kind of, that's the collaboration, the movie that I'm creating, the story that I'm telling. I'm collaborating with the reader to kind of create it in their imagination. As much as that freedom and the fun that I had writing the book were sort of got me through the first draft, I realized that the discipline that I required as a screenwriter had to come in full force, in some cases even more so writing a novel, because every single word matters in the way that every single image matters in a movie. At the same time, like a lot of first-time novelists, I didn't have a publishing deal when I wrote this book. I wrote it on the side. I had a day job. It's an uncommon day job. I was a screenwriter. I know that's not a normal day job, but it's still a job where you have deadlines and expectations and you have to deliver things. And so I started writing this book on the side, evenings and weekends, squirreling a little bit away at a time. And that was reflected actually in the structure of the book. The chapters you'll find are very short, which I love because I like the pacing of a chapter, of a short chapter. I like that, if you just feel like while you're waiting for your kettle to boil, you can read a whole chapter. If you're taking the subway to work, you can read a whole chapter. So I like the feeling of accomplishment. At the same time, it reflected each chapter initially was just what I managed to write that day, a little bit at a time. And so initially the short chapters were just how much I wrote every day. After 7 or 8 chapters, I realized that I was, that I had unintentionally ripped off Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle. It's a favorite of mine, another one of those books that I discovered on my grandfather's shelf of science fiction. And so when I realized that, I was like, well, I picked a book up again and started reading it again. I don't know. Those of you who are familiar with Cat's Cradle, it's a terrific book. It's much better than mine. You should read that. But I love the short chapters. But what I realized as I was rereading it was that a lot of the themes he was talking about were the same themes that I was exploring. Now, he was writing about it from the perspective of 1963. I was writing about it from the perspective of 2016. But, a lot of the concerns that he had about the effects of technology, the unintended consequences, and about the connections between people that provide the sort of lattice of meaning of our lives felt very, very much what I was interested in exploring too. So I actually wrote Kurt Vonnegut into the book. Not in a heavy-handed way, but what finding that book made me realize was that, well, if there was an alternate version of the world that sort of spun off from where we are here, it's not just that technology would be different. It's not just that society would be different. Art would be different. Literature would be different. The way we tell stories would be different. And so that got me thinking about that idea that all of art and entertainment would be different. A novelist like Vonnegut, for example, who was reflecting the society around him, might have written a whole other kinds of novels. And that idea that there could be all this music, all this literature, all these movies that are completely different than what we have, by artists and writers that we know, and other ones by ones we won't have even had in this version of the world. I had a lot of fun exploring that aspect as well as, figured if I'm going to rip off Kurt Vonnegut, I might as well acknowledge it as quickly as possible in the book. But if you're going to rip people off, that's a good place to start. I think that the idea of influence that permeates the book, I think that especially with the first novel, the book becomes this kind of like box full of all the things that that you're obsessed about, the things that you're compelled by, the thoughts that you have rattling around in your mind. And this book is definitely like that. I think if you take a look at it, there's something very vulnerable. As a screenwriter, you're always kind of hiding behind all these other people, the director, the actors. You can kind of conceal yourself. With a novel, it's very much you're putting yourself forward. And so I tried to embrace that. And there is a very sort of There's a lot of autobiography in the book. It's not an autobiography. I myself have not time traveled from another dimension, just to be clear about that. But at the same time, I did work a number of things that were sort of from my own life into it. It was mentioned that part of what the book does is it grapples with the death of the character's mother. And I lost my mom in 2001 when I was 26. And it happened very suddenly. And I felt like for me, it was a real hinge point in my life. It was a time when, I was quite young. And, I was reflecting back on that time in my life and how it was a real hinge for me. I mean, for some people, that hinge point might be historical. For my grandfather, the Great Depression, for my grandmother, the Second World War, for my father, in some ways meeting my mother was a hinge point for him because he had a totally different life in a whole other country, in a whole other language before he met her. And for my mother, her life was went zigged and zagged based on various hinges of history. I was fortunate to grow up in a very, a community like Vancouver, which was a very kind of safe and protective environment, but that the death of my mom was a real hinge point for me. And so I wanted to write about that in the book as well, because I wanted to kind of have this be a book where, yes, it's playing around with a lot of fun ideas about technology, time travel, alternate reality. There's big, very big plot twists, swerves of the plot and the story that are very unexpected. At the same time, I wanted to keep rooting it in what it means to be human, because fundamentally, technology, it's just a tool. It's all about who wields it. And for me, I wanted to write a story where mortality, ethics, empathy, and compassion were still a thread that runs through the human experience. Otherwise, really, why tell a story? Because it's the characters, their connections between them, and the connections we feel with them that make it a story worth telling. So for me, a novel isn't, I never think of it as just me trying to stand on a street corner with a megaphone screaming my opinions at people. I think of it as a conversation I'm having with the books that inspired me, the authors that inspired me. And the reason to write a book is because I have these stories I want to share, and the chance to kind of connect with and have a conversation with readers and book fans like yourself. I mean, I'm assuming you're book fans. You might actually be here because you hate books, but that's fine. We can talk about that too. But the chance to kind of connect with folks like yourselves who are coming out on a beautiful sunny Sunday afternoon to talk about literature is what made this worthwhile. I'm going to read the first chapter, and then I'll read a little bit of a slightly later, although because the chapters are so short, even like a later chapter is not really that far into the book. So this will just give you a taste of the tone of the book. Vonnegut was a big influence on me, as I mentioned, both in terms of, he had such a witty, humane, compassionate worldview. He was never afraid to be critical and disappointed in humanity, but it always came from a place of warmth, of wanting us to do better. But a big thing that he said, in his writing advice was just give everybody all the information they need right away. And people should have as much information as possible so that if cockroaches were to eat the last pages of the book, the reader could finish it themselves. I don't know that I followed that part. A lot of stuff happens at the end of the book, but I definitely took that from the beginning. All Are Wrong Today is chapter one. So the thing is, I come from the world we were supposed to have. That means nothing to you, obviously, because you live here in the crappy world we do have. But it never should have turned out like this, and it's all my fault. Well, me and, to a lesser extent, my father. And yeah, I guess a little bit Penelope. It's hard to know how to start telling this story, but okay, you know the future that people in the 1950s imagined we'd have? Flying cars, robot maids, food pills, teleportation, jetpacks, moving sidewalks, ray guns, hoverboards, space vacations, and moon bases. All that dazzling, transformative technology our grandparents were certain was right around the corner. The stuff of world's fairs and pulp science fiction magazines with titles like Fantastic Future Tales and The Amazing World of Tomorrow. Can you picture it? Well, it happened. It all happened more or less exactly as envisioned. I'm not talking about the future. I'm talking about the present. Today, in the year 2016, humanity lives in a techno-utopian paradise of abundance, purpose, and wonder. Except we don't. Of course we don't. We live in a world where, sure, there are iPhones and 3D printers and, drone strikes or whatever. But it hardly looks like the Jetsons. Except it did. Except it should. And it did. Until it didn't. But it would have if I hadn't done what I did. Or no, hold on. What I will have done. I'm sorry, despite receiving the best education available to a citizen of the world of tomorrow, the grammar of the situation is a bit complicated. So that's just the first page of the book, just to kind of, I mean, to give you a sense. And also you can see even in the first page, I talked about all the sort of swarm of influences and it plays out right away. It's not even that veiled. So a character is mentioned is Penelope, and she's a crucial character in the story. Tom, my main character, and he's the narrator of the book. It's written in the first person, as you can see, and it's written as a sort of a false memoir. And I wanted the story to not just be, to tell this kind of like, you know, this sort of page-turning yarn, but also to position it very specifically in the point of view of the character. Part of that's a personal taste thing. I like when books acknowledge that they're a book, you know? I mean, it's not, obviously there's many wonderful masterpieces of literature that have been written in the third person. I'm not taking a stand against the third person. I just want to be clear about that. But I like it when the book acknowledges that it's a point of view, because every writer, whether they're writing in the first person, the third person, or the second person, or even the fourth person, that was a grammar joke. I apologize. People always have their blinders. They have their biases. They don't have to be they have both negative and positive. They have things that frame their perspective. And I wanted this to be a story about a character who has this perspective in the beginning, and his perspective widens. It deepens. He gets richer as the story goes on. And I wanted it not just to be a narrative journey where all the plot twists and turns are coming at you and you don't know what's going to happen next, but where there's an emotional journey as well, where the character is growing and changing. And the person we leave on the last page of the book is a very different person than the one who begins because of his experiences. To me, that's, again, one of the things that makes a story worth telling, is that you're on a journey with the character. Part of this character's journey is Penelope. She's a character who he knows in a certain way in one version of the world. She works for his father, and he meets a very different version of her in our world. And this kind of ties into an overarching theme of the book, which is that most of the time, in my experience, the reasons we do things are very personal. You know, we all have our ideals, our philosophies, our careers take us certain ways. History, the sweep of history moves us this way and that, like a, you know, stick bobbing through a river, but that was a very literary metaphor. You're welcome. But I think most of the time, the choices that we make are personal choices. They're about people, and they're particularly about love, for better and for worse. I don't know about you, but most of the best decisions I've ever made and most of the worst decisions I've ever made were because of love. So Tom has a very complicated relationship with this woman, Penelope, and it gets more complicated as he finds a totally different version of her, one who doesn't know him at all in our version of the world. And part of the fun of the book, for me as a writer and hopefully for a reader, is as it's not just peeling back the layers of my main character, it's all the people in his life. I like to explore this idea, how much of who you are is you, some essential kind of core, and how much of it is a result of circumstances, where you were born, what era you were born in, what your parents did, what kind of family dynamic you had, what your profession turned out to be, all of these things. How much of that is the accumulation of those things make you who you are, and how much of it is some essential core? So part of this story is peeling back those layers on the characters, not just Tom, but all of the main characters in the book, and finding out who they are in their essence. But I'm going to read you a chapter which tells us a little bit about, again, this is very early. It's chapter 7, but it's like page 15. So don't worry, I'm not giving too much away. But this is a little bit about Penelope from Tom's perspective when he gets to know her, which of course gradually evolves. But this is when he's just getting to know her. Chapter 7. Penelope Weschler was supposed to be an astronaut. In early age evaluation matrices, she indicated the necessary mental aptitude, physical capability, and unwavering ambition. Even as a child, Penelope immediately knew this was the correct path for her and wanted nothing else. She trained nonstop, both in and out of school, not to walk on the moon. Anybody could walk on the moon. Anybody could go for a month-long orbital cruise. Penelope would cross the next frontier, deep space exploration. It wasn't just the studying, the training, the constant testing. It was social, or really antisocial. For long-term space operations, the recruiting agencies, they want you to grow up with parents and siblings so you have empathy models to apply to fellow astronauts on missions that last years, sometimes decades. They want you capable of caring about other people. But they don't want you to actually miss anyone back home too much, so you don't have a breakdown 6 months into a six-year mission. It's a sliding psychological scale. Self-assured loners whose parents never divorced are good. Shark-eyed sociopaths, less so. From junior high on, Penelope maintained amicable but purposefully limited personal relationships, so she wouldn't have anybody tethering her to Earth. And she was utterly kick-ass. Top of her cohort across all categories, universally recognized as a natural mission leader. She'd be a pioneer. She'd see the storms of Jupiter with her own eyes and surf the rings of Saturn on a spacewalk. And that was worth not having close friends or romantic relationships or a loyal dog. Everything was going according to plan until the first time she went to space. The launch was flawless. Penelope performed her functions with such precision, they would have used it to teach incoming recruits how gloriously capable an astronaut can be. She was prepared. She was ready. She was perfect. Until she passed through the top layer of Earth's atmosphere, and her mind went completely blank. There's a small subset of people whose cognitive functions get scrambled in outer space. Something about how the pressure change of the vacuum affects the bonds between molecules and the neurons of their brain, no one's even sure why it happens. But Penelope was one of that subset. Somehow this fact eluded the years of rigorous screening. One moment she's deftly guiding the launch vehicle through the final atmospheric layers, seeing the gaping expanse of space for the first time, her heart beating in measured but ecstatic bursts, the happiest she's ever felt. And then, nothing. She doesn't know who she is. She doesn't know where she is. She doesn't know what to do. Something in her basic constitution keeps her from having a panic attack, as most people would if they suddenly woke up piloting a goddamn spacecraft with the planet receding behind them. But she can't remember anything. The instrument panel she'd spent years mastering means nothing to her. Inscrutable acronyms printed over lights flashing in seemingly random patterns. She stares out the viewing dome at the radiant vapor of stars smeared across the black canvas of space, like the pollen clouds that would rise from the cedar trees in her grandparents' backyard when the squirrels jumped from branch to branch, although she can't understand why she's thinking about something she hasn't seen since she was 8 years old, when there are these voices in her earpiece getting loud and insistent. "I'm sorry," she said, "but I'm not really sure where I am right now." Her co-pilots, just as well trained and keening with tiny flames of envy at how far ahead of them she'd always ranked, relieved Penelope of her duties. They had to abort the mission at no small expense because her unpredictable presence endangered everyone. Just like that, Penelope, the best of the best of the best, became a threat. Strapped into an observation seat for the abrupt return home, she watched the Earth loom below her, lacquered blue and swirled with meteorological haze. Her eyes burned with tears. It was the most beautiful thing she'd ever seen, and she'd never see it again, even if she didn't know it yet. Back on Earth, her mental capacities returned to normal. She understood her career as an astronaut was over. She'd planned to spend decades off-planet. Instead, she got to experience less time in space than a tourist who'd splurged for a Sunday afternoon jaunt through the thermosphere on a discount shuttle. The same brain that made her the perfect astronaut made it impossible for her to do the job. This would have crushed most people. But Penelope wasn't most people. After a few months swimming deep into a gravity well of spiraling depression and refusing any pharmaceutical intervention in case it affected medical qualification for another endeavor, she found a new ambition to fuel her talent for punishing rigor. If she couldn't be an astronaut, she'd be a chrononaut. And chrononauts are what I call these people working on this prototype time travel. See, in this version of the world, the most of the world economy has transitioned to entertainment, you know, because technology has solved most of, you know, there's not a lot of menial manual jobs anymore. Technology takes care of that for you. So almost everything, even scientific discovery, has been repackaged as entertainment. So if you want to develop something as cutting edge as time travel, you have to find a way to market it. And so Tom's father, Victor Baron, who's this sort of cutting edge scientist working in this sort of pioneering field, basically, he's developing time travel vacations, and Penelope is working with him on sort of what will be the first mission. Of course, that's when things start to go horribly awry, as they often do when we introduce time travel into our lives. Anyways, I just wanted to read a little bit of the book. Is there any other questions? Yeah. I think, to me, I spent a lot of time thinking about that. Like, how did we get here? You know, and I mean, there's a lot of reasons. It's not one thing. There's deficits of ingenuity as well as infrastructure. But a lot of it, I think, comes down to fuel. You know, I mean, regardless of what, I don't know, whatever opinion you have on climate change. I mean, again, fact and fiction, you can choose your world that you want to live in. The thing about fossil fuels and our dependence on them is that they're very inefficient. I mean, more than anything else, whether you think they're changing the environment or whatever, I mean, they are, just so you know. But It's that they're not very efficient. They create a lot of waste. They don't produce that much energy for how much effort it takes to actually get them out of the planet and to refine them. And so I think fuel has been our biggest problem. And so part of the backstory of this world is that there was a development, an invention back in the mid-60s, a discovery of clean fuel, which was created this the opportunities for human ingenuity to be unshackled from the limitations of fuel. Even now, as we're trying to shift, as much as we can to renewables and solar and wind and all kinds of stuff, the limitations we still face are on how much energy we can produce. I'm always fascinated by, people talking about artificial intelligence. Everybody's super into AI right now. But I thought this was totally interesting. They kind of created a simulation they wanted to simulate 1% of a human brain, 1% of what our brains can do. And they realized it would take it would take about an acre of processors. It would be so hot that they would need the amount of water they would need to cool it down would be like a lake full of water, and they would actually require the entire output from a nuclear reactor just to get 1% of a human mind. And so, I love all, people are so enthusiastic about AI, but a lot of the limitations we have are power. And it's amazing that so think about it, that was 1%. Our brains are managed to produce obviously 99% more than that, and our brains only generate 25 watts of energy. Just as you're sitting all here, your brain could power a 25 watt light bulb. Congratulations. But I find that kind of stuff fascinating, right? What happened? What happened was power. The answer to my childhood question, so I did a lot of research. I don't put it all in the book. I did a ton of research. I love to go down these sort of wormholes of quantum physics and engineering and figure out how things work. I try to keep that stuff out of the book, except what you need to know to make the story work for you. But I find that stuff very interesting. The very simple answer that I could have told myself as a 10-year-old, why did I not get a jetpack for my birthday, is that the fuel would be too unstable. It would blow up, and that would be a terrible birthday present. Even now, you talk about, there's a thing called the ideal rocket equation. And what that is, it says, there's a lot of very complex math, but it boils down to get a vehicle from the surface of the planet up into orbit, 90% of the mass of the vehicle has to be fuel, right? So every time you shoot a rocket up, that's why they keep blowing up, is because 90% of it is fuel. That's what requires to escape gravity. And so I find that kind of stuff interesting. Until we develop better fuel sources that aren't quite so unstable and inefficient, we're going to be shackled. Our imagination will be shackled by the limitations of our power, both figuratively and literally. There's a literary thing I did there. Any other questions? Yeah. So the question is, in this sort of the book opens in this alternate version of the world where technology has solved a lot of human problems, not necessarily personal and emotional problems, but the big picture stuff. And the question was, is that sort of, do I believe that philosophically? And so am I sort of promoting that as technology is the fix? And I would say that yes and no. I think that it's more complicated than that, like most things. I think fundamentally, utopias I think about utopias the way I think about conspiracy theories, which is that they're comforting because they tend to reduce things to simple black and white, right? Why do people like conspiracy theories? Because it says this is to blame. This person, this group of people, this shadowy organization is to blame for our problems. And if we can just excise them like a tumor, everything is going to be okay. Where, in fact, the world is very messy, very complicated. It's not black and white. It's all kinds of shades of gray. And the reason that sort of generally speaking, which is not to say that there are never shadowy organizations doing things. I suppose there probably are, possibly watching us right now, possibly listening in right now. But I think I tend to be in favor of complexity. And so when it comes down to whether technology can solve our problems, I think it can solve many of our problems. I think access to technology, I think access to resources. I think poverty and and disease and class dynamics can be resolved in a great part by wider access to technology. At the same time, I don't think it's going to solve everything because technology is a tool and it's all about how it's wielded and who wields it. The version of the world, part of why I decided to set my version of the world as rooted in the mid-60s is because I agree, right now if somebody were to invent some kind of unlimited clean fuel, it probably would be taken over by a corporation, and suddenly anybody who wants it would have to pay quite a bit of money for it. We don't live in the same world as we did back then. I chose 1965 as a kind of a pivot point in history because the early 60s to me seemed very much of a piece of the 50s, that kind of post-war mentality. As things started to turn into the late 60s, the 70s, it wasn't just that that music got better. It was that there was skepticism, anti-authority perspectives, a lot of questions about gender and race and rights became much more part of the conversation. Society got very tumultuous because people were asking a lot of questions and they were no longer willing to the same old answers weren't working for them anymore. And so it felt like a time when society was kind of wobbling and then went off in the direction that led to our version of the world. And so, yeah, I mean, part of the book is exploring like why that utopian vision of the future has changed and why it doesn't totally apply to our world now, but we have other, we have to imagine new futures. You know, we live in a world of complexity. We live in a world where it is gray, where it is nuanced. And we all have to take responsibility for the consequences of our behavior, of our choices, but to live in the world we want to be living in. We all can make the individual choices now more than ever. I mean, I think that a lot of people right now are more aware of that than ever, that how important each individual voice is in trying to get us from where we are to the version of the world that we want to live in. And so fundamentally what the book ends up being about, not to like give away the ending, but is about personal responsibility and how taking responsibility for the consequences of your choices. It's not just how we're going to help get ourselves to a better version of the world. It's also how your life, you find meaning and purpose and happiness in life. That was very inspiring. Are there any other questions? Yeah. I'm going to say spoiler alert for those listening to the podcast or who haven't read the book. I'm not going to give anything too much away, but... Oh, yes. So the question is, well, I was just prefacing that. So there is a shift in perspective that happens later in the book. And there is a character who is much more, who's more of like a sociopath and who certainly has a much kind of like a colder and more aggressive point of view than the narrator. And that was very difficult to write because I like a warm, inviting, sort of self-effacing, complicated perspective. And this is a perspective of somebody who's purely narcissistic, who's only out for themselves, who only cares about the world insofar as it pertains to them. Does it sound like I'm describing anybody we all know? Leslie, I was super political. I was definitely, like finding that part of me to write that part was challenging, but I also felt like it was important for the story because, again, what I was trying to do was take this character and start peeling layers away. And we all have a sense of who we are, and part of our sense of who we are is time travel is a fun idea. I love time travel stories, but I think it's natural to imagine, okay, if I made, go back, if I made some different decision, how different my life would be. But we kind of think about we would be the same, right? Like our circumstances would be, maybe we'd be married to somebody else, we'd have a different job, whatever, some bad thing that happened or some terrible decision we made would be wiped out and everything would be great for us. But we think we'd be the same person. But what if we, who we are, is the accumulation of all those experiences that even our bad decisions lead us to be the person who we are? So that idea of like showing up in another time, in another version of life, why would you think you'd be the same person? You might have an essential core, but how many things can be peeled away and have you still be a version of yourself that you recognize? So that part of the book was important to me because I had to peel the character back to the essential core and expose some darker things about him that then become what propel him to actually need to change. I think that again, this is something I got from Kurt Vonnegut. You have to love your characters so much that you're willing to make horrible things happen to them. Because it's only when bad things happen to a character that we discover who they are. When I was young, I always thought that the most kind of like the lamest and most dishonest thing about Hollywood movies is that they say that everybody changes, right? Hollywood movies are always about how people change, right? They, over the course of the experience, they change, they become a different, more healthy, more grown person. That's every Hollywood movie. It says people change. And when I was young, I was like, that's a lie. Nobody changes. nothing could make you change. But that was the perspective of somebody who hadn't had anything bad happen to them, really. I was lucky. I mean, it's not like nothing bad ever happened, but I think when I was young, you know, I grew up in an environment where I had a very protective, supportive life. And so when nothing bad has happened to you, you feel like nobody ever changes. As I grew older, particularly after the death of my mother, but I've gone through other things in my life as well, I actually realized that I was wrong. That in fact, the only honest thing about Hollywood movies is they say that nobody changes unless they're forced to. Unless a crisis happens, circumstances happen that do not allow you to stay the way you were, that push you out of your comfort zone, out of your status quo. Only when a crisis happens that's so big that you can't go back will you change. And I think that's kind of true. I think that crisis is what defines us, you know. And so I wanted to create a situation for my character where, I mean, he create, you know, like on the one hand, yes, there's like he causes a break in the timeline. The space-time continuum is rewritten. But that's a very like conceptual idea until he goes through a personal crisis about himself, you know, until he discovers, like Penelope did, I mean, little literary trick, like Penelope did on that spaceship when her mind went blank, he discovers he's the threat. And when he discovers he's the threat, he's forced to change. Any other questions from anybody? Yeah. Oh, so there's a couple spots in the book. Again, a little bit spoiler. So the question was, there's a couple spots in the book where there's these little summary chapters where I recap what's happened. And so why do I do that? Well, there's a couple answers. You may have gleaned this from me. Like, I never do anything for one reason. I do things for, like, 10 different reasons. That's sort of how my brain works. But number one, very simply, I know that a lot happens in the book. There's a lot of swerves and twists and turns. And I kind of like every once in a while to just be like, don't worry. This is what has happened. I know it felt like we were swerving all over the place, but like it's actually much more straightforward than it probably felt when you were reading it. Because on the one hand, this is a book that spans utopias and dystopias and timelines and vast spans of this character's life. And at the same time, I always kept this as you know, very much as a sort of a North Star. It's also just 3 weeks in the character's life. It's a crazy 3 weeks. It's a tumultuous 3 weeks. It's a 3 weeks full of, you know, all kinds of twists and turns and big revelations, but it's still just 3 weeks. And so those little chapter summaries, on the one hand, were a way to just keep the reader with me. And at the same time, as you described, I don't want to give it away for the reader, but there's also another reason why they're there. And maybe you haven't got to that part in the book yet. So they'll also be explained a little bit. So there's actually like a meta-fictional reason why they're there that play into the character's own sort of exploration of his identity. So part of writing a book is it's fun to write a book. And so you can do things like that, and you don't really know why they're there. Part of what I want is for you to be like, why are there these chapter summaries here? I mean, it was helpful because now I'm sure I know what happened. But I like to play with that. I like to make sure that for you as a reader, when you're asking those questions, there are answers. And so a little bit later in the book, you'll find out that there's a very good reason why those chapter summaries are there, a very good reason which makes the narrator question everything that's happened to him up until that point. Sounds good. I understand. The book only came out like 4 days ago. So I mean, first of all, let me just say thank you to everybody who's like read it thus far. That's amazing for me. Question is, there was any part of this story that was particularly hard to write, that I was dreading writing? I mean, the part of the perspective shift that happens that the other gentleman asked, that was the hardest part of the book to write, because I do love these characters. I love my main character, even though, I mean, when the book begins, you know, he's irresponsible. He's a bit callow. I mean, I think he's funny and charming, but it's sort of like he's, you know, he's coasting through life. And I'm not like that personally. Like but at the same time, I was always very compassionate to him, and you hope the reader is as well. And he grows as the story goes on. But at that point in the story, like, I don't like who he becomes. You're not supposed to. And so that was hard to write, because I'm putting myself in the perspective of now taking a character who I love and making and turning him inside out. And so that was hard to write. It's also just a very, you know, very bad things happen to people that he loves and characters that I love. And I felt that those were important, because unless bad things happen, there's no stakes to the story. Like, you know, I want to put the reader in a position where you're like, you don't know what's going to happen. And so those were hard chapters to write, because they're painful for the people that are experiencing them. The other chapter that was hard to write, but in a fun way, was, so there's again, I don't want to spoil too much, but there's more than one kind of time travel in the book. And the second iteration of time travel was very mind-bending. And because I like to think of, you know, I thought about it that in the one version, the first time, it's very clean time travel. The second version, which is appropriate for our messy world is very messy time travel. And I wanted to kind of try both ways. And so the second version of it is a lot more complex and a lot more mind-bending. So it was hard to get my brain there, but it was fun. I find challenges as a writer what make the writing fun. I mean, even when they're sort of, the challenges are a little bit painful, that's what makes it, for me as a writer, you want to convey that fun to the reader. So when I'm doing stuff that's kind of stretching my abilities, and I'm not, you know, when I start the chapter, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to end it. That's, I mean, I hope, and I like that if the reader feels that way too. They're like, where are we going? And that to me is like, I try to have that energy be in the text so that it's as much a experience for the reader as it was for me as a writer. One more perfect question that sums up all the themes of this conversation and will send everybody out of this room on a cloud of insight and serenity. So the question is, speaking of challenges as a writer, I've sold the movie rights. So Paramount Pictures and Amy Pascal have acquired the movie rights, and I'm in the process of adapting it right now. And it's super hard. You know, I wrote this to not write a movie, and here I am. No, look, it's been great. It's very challenging, but it's a fun kind of challenge. I wanted to write a book that was very much a book. Like, if you read this book, you're not going to be like, this is just a movie pretending to be a book. It's very much a book that embraces its literariness. I wanted the experience of reading it to be something that you could only get in a book. And I'm doing the same thing with the movie. So you do have to kind of like boil it down to its essence. Who are these characters? What are the themes? What are the key elements of the plot? And sometimes there's some reinvention. So if you see the movie, there's going to be stuff that is a little bit different than what's in the book. And then other things, it's going to be, you know, as faithful as possible to the essence of it. But I'm trying to write a movie that embraces what a movie does really well, as opposed to what a book does well. There certainly are days where I'm at my desk typing the screenplay, and I feel like I'm literally just like ripping pages out of the book and throwing it over my shoulder, because you can't do everything. But at the same time, like, it's also kind of like a gift to be able to like rethink, how can I tell the same story with the same themes that were so compelling to me that they were worth writing a novel about in a different medium and tell the story in a different way. So it's a good kind of challenge, but definitely a challenge. Well, thank you all for coming. I hope you get some sunshine. Vitamin D, super important, especially in these stressful times. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you again to the Seattle Public Library and to Elliott Bay Book Company for hosting me here. I grew up in Vancouver, just up the road. Been to Seattle many times in my life. I love the city, and it's just so rewarding to have such a warm welcome. So thank you very much. Hope you all have a wonderful afternoon. Thank you very much.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.